From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Unprecedented. The word has been used a lot over the past 2 weeks. Unprecedented attacks, unprecedented terror, unprecedented tragedy. Another precedent set over a decade ago suggests how the press will cover what CNN has dubbed America's new war. Think back to the first time Dick Cheney and Colin Powell ran a war effort, and a president named George Bush called the shots.
In this week's New Yorker, Joe Klein said that the Gulf War is widely considered to be an abject failure, but that hardly seems to jibe with public perception. The American public saw laser-guided missiles, they saw the liberation of Kuwait, and they saw press conferences where a clueless press corps jeopardized American security, so hilariously depicted in a sketch 12 years ago on Saturday Night Live.
Colonel, knowing what you know, where would you say our forces are most vulnerable to attack, and how could the Iraqis best exploit those weaknesses?
Well, again, this falls into that area of information that might be useful to the enemy, and I just can't divulge it.
It was a case of the military being more media savvy than the media. Colin Powell says that once he saw the sketch, he knew that he had won over the public. On the other hand, you have the Academy Award-nominated movie Wag the Dog, which depended on the audience being in on the joke that propaganda and misinformation proliferated during the Gulf War. But that was a peacetime movie. Last week on the CNN program Talk Back Live, host Bobby Batista read this viewer email.
Carol in Florida says, I'm disturbed by the instantaneous reporting of what the military is planning or doing. Do you realize that you may be putting those military men and women in more danger by breaking security?
Here you have the press and the Pentagon both claiming to act in the public interest. Pete Williams has been a member of both of these institutions. He's now a correspondent for NBC. During the Gulf War, he conducted those briefings in his capacity as spokesman for the Pentagon.
I remember vividly sitting in my office when that Saturday Night Live thing came on, and I saw the setting and, people in a briefing, and I thought, oh boy, we're going to really get it now, and was very surprised at the tone of it. I mean, I'm not sure that I agree that the public was upset at journalists during the Gulf War briefings. I think it just took a little while for, the public to realize that certain things could be reported without jeopardizing operations, and some journalists to be maybe a little more sensitive to time things. One thing that struck me was when the Scud missiles started coming toward where reporters were stationed. At first, reporters who were doing live reports were quite vivid in saying, well, that one missed us by about a mile to the northwest. And then it occurred that that would be kind of important information for the people firing those to have on how to adjust. It was a learning experience for everybody because it was the first military operation where information came out so immediately.
Let's say there was some sort of mumbling going on. Maybe questions weren't so artfully phrased during the Gulf War. But do you think that no matter how carefully and cleverly phrased the question was, there was a single military briefer who was going to disclose something other than what he was prepared to disclose going in?
Certainly not. The briefings were done by an Army Lieutenant General named Tom Kelly, who was Director of Operations for the Joint Staff. He was the guy who briefed the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff every morning. He knew precisely what could be said and what couldn't be said. And the other briefer was a Navy one-star, Mike McConnell, who was Director of Intelligence for the Joint Staff. So they were both very sensitive about what could and couldn't and be said. They were often telling me what they thought was appropriate to say and not to say.
Okay, that was the Gulf War. That was 10 years ago, and it was a war. It was a conventional war with sorties and ground troops and a clear enemy and a battleground that you could see, that you could actually photograph. Whatever the war that we're heading into now may be, it's clearly not going to be what the Gulf War was. How in the world can the press cover this thing?
Well, I think the answer is I don't know. I'm not sure the Pentagon knows. If part of it is, as the president has implied, special operations forces, then, we may never hear about that. Many of the things that the Army's special operations people do are never publicly discussed. On the other hand, the places the military might go and do more visible things, like Afghanistan, Pakistan, wherever they may be, there's no battlefield that is controlled by one side or the other. So I suppose it's possible some of this may happen before your very eyes.
Is there any chance that the war has already started? We just haven't been informed?
Oh, I think there's every chance of that. Yes, of course, it's theoretically possible.
Let's say, for example, the war actually is going on. There are things happening even as we speak, and that the Pentagon, at least for the time being, takes the position that, well, for reasons of operational security, you know, we'll get back to you when this is over. And because of the passions that are so ignited at the moment, the public is satisfied with that answer. Do you think the public could be satisfied with that answer once American soldiers and sailors start coming home in body bags?
One, I understand why you asked the question. I, as a former Pentagon spokesman, though, can never buy into the theory that the government will calibrate the amount of answer it gives out based on public passions at home. That cannot be the reason for saying something or not saying something. There are operational reasons. There are intelligence reasons for withholding information, period.
Well, the political arm of the government does that all the time. You're saying the military never bases its handling of the press in whole or in part on the public opinion and public mood?
Yeah, maybe in peacetime, but during a military operation, it would not be appropriate for the Pentagon to say, well, today we're going to give out a lot of information because we think the public is with us. Tomorrow we're not because we think the public isn't. No one ever said that to me when I was there.
Let's just go back one more time to the Gulf War and talk about the Patriot missiles. When they were first used against the Scuds that were launched into Saudi Arabia and into northern Israel, the reports of success in the intercepts were very encouraging. And if I recall correctly, received with just only a modicum of skepticism at the time. After the war, we learned that, yeah, there were intercepts, but they didn't actually affect the warheads themselves, and that the anti-missile missiles didn't work nearly as well as we had been led to believe.
They didn't work as well, not only as we were led to believe, but as people at the Pentagon themselves believed at the time. I never knew of a situation where anyone was trying to pull a fast one on the public by artificially or dishonestly or incorrectly trying to fluff up the image of the Patriot in the face of evidence to the contrary. It was more we were all kind of learning as we went along. That was also the case with the Scud Hunters. There was that memorable briefing where General Schwarzkopf had videotape that he said was U.S. military planes striking with missiles, Scud launchers. Well, a thorough review by the Pentagon after the war revealed that those were not Scud launchers at all. They were fuel trucks. But General Schwarzkopf certainly thought at the time they were launchers. That's what his intelligence said, and that's what he said publicly. And, you know, this gets to a problem in terms of putting out in the information in the middle of combat. There's an old expression in the military, first reports from the field are always wrong. What do you do when you're standing up there in front of the public and the press and they ask you a question? You have an option. You can say, well, this is what we know now. Come back tomorrow and I might know better. Or you can say, I don't know the answer. I don't have all, you know, come back to me in 3 months when we've had a chance to scrub it. Well, you know, obviously that's not a very, that second one is not a very viable option.
Well, Pete Williams, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Pete Williams is a reporter for NBC TV and formerly the spokesman for the U.S. Department of Defense.
In the early hours after the Twin Towers fell, hundreds of journalists swarmed over the rubble. Among them were a handful who had covered man-made catastrophes in other places like Rwanda and Kosovo and Beirut. The Boston Globe's Elizabeth Neufer is one of those reporters, and she joins us now. Elizabeth, welcome to On the Media.
Nice to be here.
So, tell me about the wars that you've covered.
Well, I've covered the Gulf War. I covered the war in Bosnia. I covered the early parts of the war in Kosovo, and not really a war, but sort of the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda.
I assume you saw absolutely horrible things there.
Each one has had a different horror to it. I mean, in some cases, the horror has been dead bodies, and in other cases, it's been in sort of the desperation of the people who've been ethnically cleansed from their homes.
Did the situation you covered in New York remind you of any of those?
There have been phenomenal, eerie parallels. And it's one of the things I keep sort of remarking on to friends is that on September 11th, when I found myself down at what has now been called Ground Zero, that I felt as if I had actually stepped on a plane and had appeared in one of the battlefields that I knew so well, because here were the sort of all the familiar landmarks, you know, photographers out, you know, rescue crew, injured people, And yet I, you know, everyone was speaking English.
Did the actual Ground Zero itself remind you of other places you'd been?
No, the closest thing to it would have been the bomb that hit the marketplace in Sarajevo in 1994. And I really thought that having seen that, I had seen kind of what a bomb could do. That killed 68 people and left corpses scattered around the marketplace. This was actually very different. One of the things that made it so strange was the absence of bodies and the fact that there was a sense you had stepped into a nuclear winter. Everything was covered with this thick white dust, and there was this fog and swirling smoke and people sort of emerging in and out of rubble. There are items of clothing and shoes, but there was no body to be found. There was no blood. It had, in that sense, a very stark, sinister quality to it because there was almost a lack of humanity to the whole process.
Except for the humanity teeming around you trying to cope with the damage.
Right. And that, as I said, you know, it was such a familiar scene. I've seen it so many times that what seemed striking, in fact, was the fact it was happening in my own backyard.
You are so used to covering foreign catastrophe, foreign war for our domestic American audience. What was it like trying to translate something on American soil for an American audience?
In some ways, I think it's actually made it a lot easier because when you cover a place like Bosnia, I mean, the problem we always had to overcome, first of all, was people's indifference. Not that they meant to be indifferent, but they were caught up in their own lives, and Bosnia seemed a long way away, and the war and violence seemed a long way away. And now that this has happened here, ironically, I'll be curious to see if it, you know, when the next conflict occurs overseas, if we're going to have quite such a barrier to overcome and when we try to bring it home.
Do you think it may have brought then all those faraway places that much closer?
It's been unbelievable to me to be interviewing people in the last couple of days, and the vocabulary is identical. People keep talking about needing justice, wanting to see people tried, or they simply want justice in a more immediate sense, which is a body returned. I did a story about the fact that families are now struggling to cope with the fact there will perhaps be no bodies to bury. And this is a situation identical to that faced by the women of Srebrenica, who, you know, there were 8,000 men and boys that were killed after the fall of the UN safe haven. Those bodies have been dumped in mass graves that still haven't even been found.
Elizabeth Neufer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Boston Globe reporter Elizabeth Neufer is author of The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda, due out in November.
Coming up, the news business says it gives America what it wants. So will it now finally give America foreign news?
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the past dozen years or so, network news has justified its dwindling foreign coverage by citing American indifference. They've saved money by consolidating bureaus and cutting support staff. Now the networks have mobilized fresh news teams in the Middle East and Central and South Asia to cover a war with no specific field of battle. We wondered if all this signaled a change in network news priorities. Marcy McGinnis, vice president of news coverage for CBS, says her network has never stinted on news coverage.
To say we have fewer foreign bureaus isn't really the way to look at it. We reorganized our news gathering operation a few years ago and basically moved people around and put the bulk of the people in London, Tel Aviv, Moscow, and Tokyo in terms of foreign bureaus. we decided that the places to be, you had to be near a big airport. You had to have people that were able to get to places quickly. And that's where a place like London comes in, because you can get anywhere from London very quickly. It's impossible to have bureaus in every single major city in the entire world. It's just impractical and not efficient.
Now, in the beginning, I was reading that newsrooms were sparing no expense to get reporters in place in Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's been over 2 weeks since the attacks. Are people now beginning to take another look at their budgets?
You know, we never stop looking at our budget, but, you know, the activity over there hasn't really started, you know, so we're still gearing up to be in place for when the, quote, retaliation or whatever it is going to start. The networks will go to unbelievable lengths to cover this story and try and cover every single angle that we can possibly cover. You know, we're not holding back on our resources. We're not saying, let's not do this because it's going to cost money. The conversations about money are simply, you know, make smart decisions. Don't decide not to do something because of the cost. Just decide that you're going to make the smart decisions to do it.
This was a wake-up call. Some say. Is it a wake-up call for the networks to say, public be damned, we're going to do more foreign coverage whether you're going to watch it or not?
I just don't think that that's the way we think. I don't think we say we're putting something on TV and whether you watch it or not, we're putting it on anyway. I mean, if you're Kmart and you say, I'm going to sell mink coats and nobody in Kmart buys them, Kmart goes out of business. So we're going to cover the important stories here. And there are certainly going to be enough interesting and important stories for us to cover that the viewer is going to watch them.
Well, Marcy McGinnis, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Marcy McGinnis is the Senior Vice President for News Coverage for CBS News. Chris Kramer is the President of CNN International Networks. Chris, we just heard Marcy McGinnis say that putting reporters in jumping-off points like London is an efficient and effective way to cover the world. Do you agree?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I think it's convenient and it's seductive to think that you can have experts who jump off from one part of the world to another. There's no substitute to having people in country who speak the language, who know what's going on there and know what's significant, what's important. And I think it has been a sorry day when organizations, for reasons that I understand, which have primarily been, exclusively been financial reasons, have, you know, withdrawn back behind the balance sheet and have brought their troops home. This is an inadequate form of reporting.
Is CNN International as ratings-driven as the domestic CNN?
No, for one fundamental reason. It's not that we don't like ratings, it's that there are very few rating systems available outside of the U.S. We are available to something like 160 million households in about 210 countries and territories, mostly to travelers, people who are generally affluent, who are opinion formers, the type of people that advertisers around the world happen to like. So it is a good business and it's a good journalistic venture as well.
Do you think that a network should pay more attention to the stories it thinks are important or the stories that the public thinks are important?
Listen, I may be responsible for a very large piece of American global brand out there, but beneath this, you know, gray suit beats the heart of a journalist. I happen to believe that it's possible to make significant stories interesting. I happen to believe that you can make important stories interesting.
But among Americans running television networks, CNN has alone the luxury of devoting more attention and resources to stories of international significance.
Well, I mean, the word luxury is a curious one, but let's slave to it. The CNN has made a choice to covering the globe, not just one particular part of it. One of the singular reasons we maintain such a broad spread of bureaus around the world is because of the insatiable appetite of our international services and the fact that they're successful businesses in their own right. So, you know, if we just had a domestic CNN, it's arguable that we would not have this spread of bureaus.
But would you concede that the American television networks haven't quite got that latitude because their audience is, strictly speaking, American?
Well, I don't have many colleagues in network news, and they quite properly have a public voice and a private voice. And I think more of them than not would agree with my assertion that the once great broadcast networks that were once renowned for having an international bureau spread have been forced to close most of those international bureaus. The American networks, with the exception of CNN, does not have a single bureau on the continent of Africa. That can't be an intelligent journalistic decision. It simply can't be. I do not believe that the U.S. media can provide an intelligent assessment of the importance of Africa by sending in people from London or from New York or Washington. I simply don't accept that as a journalistic piece of logistics.
But is it the networks or is it the American public that is failing to recognize what's interesting?
That is a key point. And my view is that here we engage in a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't give them international news, then how can they possibly understand the importance of international news? What human being could fail to be interested or indeed captivated by the fact that we'd here have a large influx of population from Afghanistan, where we might have the Talibanization of Pakistan, a nation that has the nuclear device? How could a population anywhere in the world fail to be actually entranced and somewhat worried by that particular issue? How could they fail to be captivated by a documentary which CNN has transmitted in the last few days, Beneath the Veil, which talks about the treatment of women in Afghanistan, the fact that the authorities in Afghanistan actually take women onto public football fields and shoot them? I mean, if the audience in this country or anywhere else fails to be captivated by that, then my views about the population in this country, where I've been for 6 years, are sadly awry, and I don't believe they are.
Apropos of that, you wrote an op-ed for the French paper Le Monde in which you wrote, "I hope today that the catastrophe of September 11 will make Americans understand why isolating oneself from the rest of the world is no longer the right way. But if it doesn't do that, will the U.S. news networks realize it on their own?"
I think the broadcast networks understand that they have a public duty to their audience as well as the necessity to run an effective business. I believe with a real passion that what happened in New York and Washington will change their mindset. And I do think that they will believe and they will convince their masters that this is part of their reason for being there, part of their raison d'etre.
Chris Kramer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chris Kramer is president of CNN International Networks.
As we heard, among the more startling pieces CNN has run was Beneath the Veil, a documentary originally commissioned by England's Channel 4 to get a glimpse at life in Afghanistan under the harsh fundamentalist rule of the Taliban. The results are in equal parts shocking, infuriating, and heartbreaking.
But the international community paid for a football stadium. They wanted to the Afghan people to play football there. Instead, you are executing people there.
I'll make the international community an offer. In Afghanistan, everything has been destroyed. If they help us to build a separate place suitable for carrying out executions, we have no problem with that.
The life of ordinary Afghans was of little interest to the American media before September 11th, but footage from Beneath the Veil has since been aired on ABC's Good Morning America, Dateline NBC, and again in its entirety on CNN. Joining us now is Syra Shah, the producer of Beneath the Veil, and all of a sudden a media darling. Syra, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, good to be here.
Tell me briefly, please, the story behind Beneath the Veil. How did it come to pass?
The director, Cassian Harrison, the cameraman, James Miller, and myself were approached by Channel 4, which is a television station in Britain. They just said, go and make a film on Afghanistan. And we sort of went, well, what's the story? And they said, well, go and find out what the story is. And so we really didn't know about the massacres in the north until we got there. We didn't know too much what to expect with the Taliban, and I certainly didn't know what I find on the undercover trip that I made to Kabul. What seemed easy at the time to sort of almost ridicule the Taliban and think they were a bit silly, and what we saw there really made us realize that there was something much more sinister than that going on.
So you come back from Afghanistan and Pakistan with your footage. You cut it into a documentary. Channel 4 airs it. And then what happened?
Well, first of all, there was an amazing response at the time in Britain. Afghanistan is not a subject that, you know, people would normally care about here. And what amazed me was the next day I could hear people talking about it in their offices. And a taxi driver said to a friend of mine, oh, I'm sorry, miss, I'm not driving very well today because I saw this really distressing film on Afghanistan. And it was as though it had actually touched a chord with people, with ordinary people. Then it went out in CNN, and there was a good response to it there as well. And then really things did quieten down until this awful tragedy happened. And it was re-aired on CNN. And I think it was at that point that I know sort of all sorts of underground emails went around saying, you have to catch this film, you have to catch this film. And I think people really felt that they had to understand.
And of course, in the last couple of weeks, there's been a great deal of interest in Beneath the Veil by the major networks here. You were on Good Morning America earlier this week. You've been on Dateline NBC. Was there any interest before September 11th by the major networks in any portion of Beneath the Veil?
No, there wasn't. I wouldn't have expected it either. There wasn't interest from networks like that. As I've said, only CNN. I mean, CNN really did champion it, actually. And I suppose it's not really unreasonable before these events. I think it took these events, which were so tragic, for people to really think we have to understand about Afghanistan as a compelling domestic issue, not as a foreign issue. And that's the sort of subtle difference.
At the moment, irrespective of whether you intended any such effect, this film serves the purposes of the United States in broadening its coalition around the world and in generating antipathy towards the Taliban. How does that make you feel?
That's a really, really fundamental and interesting question. I've been really ambivalent over the last couple of weeks when there has been, as you say, this media feeding frenzy. We got angry, personally angry, with this repressive regime when we were there, and I think that shows in the film. But really, the film isn't about the Taliban. It's about the innocent people in Afghanistan, inside Afghanistan, people who are suffering under the Taliban just and are victims of the Taliban. The last thing that I will want this film to do will be to whip up support for some sort of huge strike on civilian areas where it will be the Taliban leadership who'd all disappear into bunkers or in the hills, and it will be the people like the women I met in Kabul, like the people we got to know who would suffer. These are people who've been shelled over a period of 20 years and their homes destroyed. They're living in ruins half the time. I personally would be very, very disturbed if anyone used this film as a means to say, let's just go in and nuke them.
Saira Shah, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. The aftershocks of the Trade Center attack are rumbling through all the businesses here in New York, and Broadway is not exempt. The Great White Way is facing the worst economic times in its history. Performers have taken a 25% pay cut, and they're being hurt in worse places than their wallet, as On the Media's Tony Macillas reports.
Two Jamaican musicians entertain the bustling midday crowd at Times Square. An American flag waves proudly from the shimmering metal of the steel drum. New York has once again raised its volume on the city streets. But inside many theaters, there's not a sound to be heard.
The horror that we are all experiencing together here in this city has made it, I think, very difficult for actors to perform with the same amount of animation, energy, willingness to suspend disbelief.
Alan Eisenberg of Actors Equity has been given notice of 6 show closings already, including 1,000 Clowns and the Rocky Horror Show. The fate of many others still hangs in the balance. The week of the disaster was Broadway's worst ever. Shows like Les Miserables and Phantom of the Opera depend heavily on tourism. Fewer people are flying. People are still afraid, and that includes actors. Alan Eisenberg.
When the mayor asked the acting community to go back to work on that Thursday, I think many members felt it was too early, and they felt it very difficult.
Nick Wyman has performed in the long-running hit Les Mis for over 4 years.
There's a song called Empty Chairs and Empty Tables about, lost friends in Les Mis, and I don't know how the fellow who sang it got through that night.
There's a grief that can't be spoken. There's a pain goes on and on. Empty chairs and empty tables. Now, my friends, are dead
and wrong.
Besides the hardship of losing jobs, the Broadway community, like many others across the nation, is grieving for friends and family members.
To this date, we still are afraid and have no real information as to how many of our members were involved in the World Trade Center in a temporary capacity. I mean, they temp, and certainly they would temp at the World Trade Center. They could be at the restaurant there.
Actor Nick Wyman.
Many Americans felt a sense of frustration on Tuesdays. Well, what can I do? It's why people, we flocked to the blood banks to give blood, or people rushed down to volunteer at the World Trade Center. It's like you wanted to do something. And as actors, as meager as something as that is, what we can do is we can perform for folks. We can entertain them. We can move them.
When President Kennedy died, I remember I was in a musical called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off.
Veteran actor Joel Grey.
And during the sad parts of that musical, I could actually hear audible sobbing and gasping. That mourning actually transferred itself right into the theater experience.
Joel Grey has originated many roles, including the MC in Cabaret. He recalls a time when he visited Paris immediately after a terrorist bombing.
I went there and I was invited when I arrived to a screening. And the streets were totally empty. It was a ghost town. And then there was a party afterwards. Do you want to go? Sure. They were practically drinking champagne out of ladies' shoes. It was like Berlin in the 30s. We might as well live tonight because tomorrow we may be dead.
Like other Americans, actors on Broadway are struggling to find some meaning right now, a sense of purpose for their lives. Actress Polly Bergen joined a group of actors, including Joel Grey, Bernadette Peters, Bebe Neuwirth, and more, to make a public service music video encouraging people to come back to New York theater.
Perhaps there may be some people out there that say, well, that's kind of silly and self-serving. But I truly believe in show business, we're there to bring hope and laughter and joy and even drama.
And still, new shows are rehearsing. The much-talked-about Mamma Mia is set to begin previews in October. The show's advance sales broke records, but now, even that isn't a guarantee of a long run. Louise Petra will star her first role on Broadway.
I'm even more anxious to open the show than I was before. I think what we do for a living is sometimes written off as just frivolity, but you know what? This is when we need frivolity.
A line forms at a ticket booth in Times Square. Most of the customers are New Yorkers, including this Staten Island native.
Actually, we were in Manhattan a couple of days right after the bombing. Spend money and support our city.
For them, this is an opportunity to see shows usually crowded with tourists and to do their part to help New York City. For On the Media, I'm Tony Macillas in New York.
Coming up, the view from over there and when good media goes bad.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As President Bush goes about the delicate business of coalition building for his war on terrorism, a survey of foreign media does more than reflect the debate around the world of how the first war of the 21st century should be prosecuted. Press coverage reveals that the diplomacy and deal-making are limiting the scope of the war before a single shot has been fired. Joining us once again is Martin Walker, Chief International Correspondent for United Press International. Martin, welcome back to OTM.
Nice to be back on the air with you.
Martin, we've heard an awful lot to date about the reaction in the European press. What's happening elsewhere in Pakistan, for example? What are you reading?
Well, I've been paying very close attention to a Pakistan daily called Dawn, which is getting very, very nervous about what seems to be a warming political relationship between the United States and the Northern Alliance. That's a group of tribes and anti-Taliban fighters in northern Afghanistan. And Dawn says Northern Alliance is seeking power for reasons of self-vindication and no higher purpose. They think they were the ones who waged the jihad against the Soviets and won, and therefore it is they who are the legitimate rulers of Afghanistan. This is, however, not the view shared by other sections of Afghanistan's polyglot population. A U.S.-backed Northern Alliance in power would hardly be in a position to bring peace and stability to the country. It's interesting that should be coming from Pakistan, which is, you know, clearly such a crucial supporter.
I suppose General Musharraf is proceeding with extreme caution because he doesn't know necessarily which devil to deal with, the West or with the Islamicist population in his own country. Have you seen a reflection of that dilemma in the press there?
Yes, I have, both in the news in Pakistan and in Dawn. But what's also very clear is the way in which Musharraf, and certainly his critics among fundamentalists, have been reading the Indian press. One of the editorials that I saw in the Times of India was suggesting that deep down at the bottom of all of this is a desperate concern in India that the Pakistani military government could fall and be replaced by a fundamentalist government. And I'm quoting now, the worst possible outcome would be for Pakistan's nuclear weapons to fall into the hand of a government controlled by fundamentalists, if not by Osama bin Laden himself.
This all gets to what seems to be an undermining already of this notion of an all-out war on terrorism that the president has been talking about, because already at this early stage in the all-out war, there seem to have been so many diplomatic compromises made to assuage the various members of the coalition that it's hard to know, you know, what their notion of all-out war is.
Well, that's absolutely right. I was looking at the Frankfurter Rundschau from Germany, which was saying that the decision, as it were, to appease Russia over Chechnya in order to bring Russia into the coalition was a major mistake. It says that Moscow is creating terrorists by having destroyed the country, Chechnya, in two wars and having terrorized the population. Neither Washington nor the German government should rashly or permanently welcome on board an ally with this kind of idea of the fight against terrorism.
One last stop. Silvio Berlusconi, the media titan, who also happens to be prime minister of Italy, said European culture and Western culture was superior to Islamic culture, and that in the war of the two cultures, the West would prevail. Clearly, this is the kind of remark that should result in a lot of criticism, but he controls at least the television media in Italy. How has it played?
Well, the main criticism has come from the left-wing press, and I was looking at L'Unità, which used to be the paper of the Italian Communist Party and is now a paper of a fairly broad left. And it says, at this grave and dangerous moment in international life, Silvio Berlusconi cut such a petty figure that even his political opponents are embarrassed. Well, that's not what you've been seeing on the Italian television, and it's not what you've been seeing in some of the more staid Italian press. In fact, Corriere della Sera made the point, which I hadn't seen in any of the American reports of the Berlusconi speech, that in fact what his speech was about was to suggest that the same dynamics were animating international terrorism as were animating anti-globalization militants. And that's really about Berlusconi's own internal political problem, where he's very much on the defensive over the horrendous overreaction the Italian police took in the anti-globalization riots in Genoa back in July, when one of the demonstrators was killed by the police.
Once again, Martin Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Monica Gate, way back in 1998, was described as the Internet's coming of age. The medium was celebrated for its capacity for instant exchange and automatic second-guessing that would work against propaganda and toward a more skeptical approach toward information. But on September 11th, the story of the World Trade Center attack played out on television. The Internet, as Tim Cavanaugh wrote in the Online Journalism Review, had not so much come of age as shown its age. Tim Cavanaugh joins us now. Tim, has the web provided a useful counterpoint to the conventional wisdom in this case?
What you're seeing now is the web more as a medium for disinformation than for information. I know this is a classic argument that's made against the web. You can't trust what you read. But you can learn a lot from the sort of disinformation that you see out there.
So give me an example of some perhaps illustrative pieces of misinformation that have been given play since the September 11th catastrophe.
One would be the theory that the Israeli intelligence service Mossad was behind the attack. That story sort of grew in the telling. The first email I got on that was just a few hours after the attack. To quote from that particular email I got, "War may be coming. The U.S. will be doing what Israel want them to do, in parentheses, as they always did in the past." There were many additions to that as you started to see that story grow. One was that Israel took advantage of the aftermath of the attacks to force a new crackdown on the Palestinians. Another was this thing that started to circulate that 3,000 Jews had received an early morning phone call not to report to work at the World Trade Center. That number has since been increased to 4,000.
And obviously no truth to any of these assertions.
No.
Another bit of misinformation that got out there on the web and was briefly believed until it was flatly disproved was that the footage that CNN showed of kids in the Gaza Strip celebrating the toppling of the towers was a fake. CNN said it got the footage from the BBC and was able to demonstrate that it was real, but I think that still has some lingering reverberations.
Yeah, the idea wasn't just that it was fake, but that it was actually footage from 1991 of people in the Gaza Strip celebrating the Gulf War, something that had happened in the Gulf War, I don't know what. It just had enough of a sort of whiff of plausibility to it. Obviously was also untrue. But what's interesting about both this and the earlier thing about Mossad is that, the purpose of disinformation isn't really to create counter facts. It's just to throw mud on existing facts. I think the web will be better as a gauge of public opinion than of any source of new information, as it was in the case of the Monica story or something like that.
So it'll fill those gaps of information generally with static.
Yeah, but instructive static. I mean, so much of our current game plan involves the notion that we have some sort of support in the Middle East, moderate Muslims and that kind of thing, who are going to be behind our campaign. And the kind of static that we see, I think, indicates strongly otherwise. So I think that's pretty instructive.
Back in the dawn of the dot-com era, we were told that it was going to revolutionize the world. Now that the dot-com business seems to have peaked and is in something of a retrenchment, did we give it too much credit to begin with?
Depending on how messianic the people you were talking to were, one of the things that seemed to have gone with the wind was nationalism and sort of patriotic fervor. And, there was this idea that there was going to be a lot more people just exchanging ideas and it was going to be impossible for any demagogue to get everybody thinking the same way. And
no borders.
No borders. Yeah, the no borders thing. And, clearly there's no borders to mayhem and mass murder. But whether there are borders to how people identify themselves, I think we may have jumped the gun.
Tim Kavanaugh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Kavanaugh is a contributor to the Online Journalism Review.
The Internet has clouded the story in ways both political and personal, and so have some broadcast outlets. After the Twin Towers collapsed, some of the families of the missing found their hopes lifted, shattered, then lifted again by unfounded reports. WNYC's Marianne McCune has the story of one family still hanging in doubt because of news that went nowhere.
We keep hearing the phrase hope against hope. It makes hope sound irrational, but Roxana Batista says she's had reason after reason to believe her sister, Giovanna Porras, could be alive. On the first day after the World Trade Center collapsed, a New Jersey relative found a webpage called ny.com/WTC list, one also recommended by a New York police officer.
They will write, oh, this person is fine, this person is injured, this person is critical condition, whichever the case is, you know what I mean? Her condition was critical on that website. So critical patients, they were saying that they were taking them to St. Vincent. So I just walked into St. Vincent. I said, can you please let me walk through the emergency room? They said no.
Batista says she couldn't argue. She knew if they let her roam the emergency room, hundreds more would demand access. So she diligently filed a missing person report and waited for more information.
Then the next morning, also on a site that is not official, somebody puts my sister's name there, hospitalized. So it gave me more hope.
Anyone with information on a missing person could post on the site. Derek Calancini of Creative Network Solutions in California put it up to help the victim's families and friends.
You know, you put in a first name or a last name and hit search, and it would come up with a list of matches.
Denise Aronotiki, a cousin of the missing Giovanna, was one of 10,000 hits on the site during the first 6 hours it was up. There were 150,000 the next day.
At first, my cousin appeared as if she was found. And then I look again, and it says that she was in the hospital.
Aronotiki contacted Batista, who emailed the site administrator asking who had posted regarding Giovanna. The company gave her and other inquirers what it could, an address leading to the poster's internet provider. But Derek Calancini says he couldn't lead them to an actual person.
It would lead you to somebody's network, say, for example, AT&T dial-up networking. So then somebody would have to go to AT&T, and AT&T would have to be willing to give you the information on that person.
And it became clear in any case that many of the people posting didn't themselves have any useful information. Rumors, pranks, and even threats cluttered the site.
We realized that people were just messing around and putting in bogus information and false names and stuff like that. People would come in and, you know, add George Bush, and they would add Mickey Mouse.
There were some atrocities on that list. People listed as critical in hell, people listed as dead, people listed as under the rubble, people just playing with, you know, our emotions.
It's like they lift us up in the air and they just drop us.
And the ride did not stop there.
On Wednesday night, between the hours of 8 and 9 o'clock, a family member saw on Channel 47 that a guy took out a girl named Giovanna, 24 years old. Maybe he was just saying that, but thing is that Giovanna, 24, that fits my sister perfectly.
Then a stranger contacted Roxana Batista's family, saying she'd seen a similar interview on CNN. Roxana called CNN and the Spanish-language news Channel 47 to leave messages. She begged a Channel 47 news assistant to review the tape.
She said she didn't know, and then she told me, look, ma'am, I'm gonna, you know, that's a lot of footage. I'm like, no, it's just an hour. If you can't do it, please let me come over there and I'll do it. I'll watch it. She says she will do it.
But no one called back for days. Batista called again and spoke to another desk assistant.
She told me that the reason why nobody has called me back is it must be a mistake, and I have to accept the fact that my sister might be gone, which automatically it just freaked me out that somebody could talk to you like that. That's my hope. You know, that's what I'm hoping for. That's what I'm praying for. How can you take that away from me?
The desk assistant says she only told Batista that she'd asked the station's reporters and none remembered such an interview. The news director says he'd love for it to be real, but it sounds like wishful thinking. After calls from this reporter, the station's archivist began reviewing tapes of that night's live reporting, but she hasn't been able to locate the footage from 8 o'clock to 8:45. Batista and her husband imagined Giovanna delirious in some hospital. Her husband heard from a friend that such a situation occurred.
Parents got a call, and the girl's been missing since, you know, September 11th, and they got a call from a hospital in Jersey that said, come and pick up your daughter, she's all right.
But it's unlikely that Giovanna is in a hospital somewhere. The Hospital Associations of New York and New Jersey say there are no longer any unidentified patients. The NY.com webpage listing victims of the attack has been dismantled. The other now lists Giovanna as missing. Roxana Batista has turned to an independent archiving agency to get copies of Wednesday night newscasts from both Channel 47 and CNN. She knows it's a long shot and is at the same time applying for her sister's death certificate. But once a lead is out there, it's difficult not to follow. For On the Media, I'm Marianne McCune in New York.
WSDU in New Orleans has changed its branding slogan. It used to be six on your side. Now it's six on America's side. Who cares if a media outlet cashes in on the new patriotism? It's the flip side we should care about, losing the freedom to express anything else. Recently, ABC's Politically Incorrect was dropped by some sponsors and stations for living up to its name. Host Bill Maher said that our president was frankly wrong to call the terrorists cowards. Cowards don't slam planes full of fuel into buildings, he said. We have been the cowards, lobbing cruise missiles from 2,000 miles away. Of course, by we, he meant American policy, not pilots. But ugh. As a comic, he should have had a better sense of timing. Though what he said was hardly new. We heard the same thing 3 years ago from major American newspapers and several U.S. senators when American-led NATO forces carried out airstrikes over Kosovo, unwilling to risk casualties on the ground. It's not that I, safe in my office, am questioning the courage of Allied pilots, wrote Philip Caputo in the Chicago Tribune. I am questioning the courage and steadfastness of the political leaders who have sent those pilots in harm's way. Senator John McCain said, the White House is scared to death. Neither of them was blackballed. I concede Bill Maher, being neither a Pulitzer Prize-winning author like Caputo or a decorated soldier like McCain, came off more wise-ass than wise. But it's alarming that the avalanche of condemnation that fell on him came from such remote and mighty precincts as the White House. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer.
They remind us, all Americans, that they need to watch what they say, watch what they do. And this is not a time for remarks like that. There never is.
Watch what we say, by the way, was left out of the White House transcript. But there it is. This is a time to watch what we say. There never is a time for remarks like that. But this is America, right? Where our right to be offensive is constitutionally protected. Here, there always is a time for such remarks. Actually, except for three times. In 1798, we had the Alien and Sedition Act. In 1918, the U.S. Sedition Act. In 1940, the Alien Registration Act. All three, later repealed, made it a crime to mouth off at our government. And it made our government no longer quite American. Maher's critics say, look, the government didn't punish him. The stations and the sponsors did. We let the marketplace decide. The marketplace is powerful. As powerful, arguably, as the government. But it cannot be as powerful as the Constitution. The next time Mr. Fleischer makes an off-the-cuff remark, maybe he should say something like that.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Melissa Sanford and from Channel 13 in New York. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media was brought to you by the Bidell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.